From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on This Day in Maine, Thursday, January 4th, 2018. And on this day, heavy snow, wind, and flooding in Maine. Secretary of State Matt Dunlap reacts to the cancellation of the Trump administration's Voter Fraud Commission and will remember the ice storm of 1998, 20 years later. That's all ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org.
Activities across Maine nearly ground to a halt today in the face of an intense snowstorm. The National Weather Service is warning travelers to prepare for more than a foot of snow accompanied by high winds, coastal flooding, and sub-zero temperatures after midnight on Friday. And as A.J. Higgins reports, most Mainers have heeded calls from the State Department of Transportation to stay home so plow crews can clean up the roads.
State plow trucks were already out in force in southern Maine when Susan Falloon of the Maine Emergency Management Agency conducted her morning assessment of the massive weather system.
As we continued to have conversations with the National Weather Service, the forecast seemed to be getting worse and worse.
As government agencies and schools closed, public safety officials focused on highway and travel conditions that deteriorated by noon. But even as emergency protocols were put into place, Susan Falloon was thinking about the next 48 hours.
Of course, the big concern is going to be the travel conditions and then the drifting snow, which is going to continue even after the snowstorm stops. The travel conditions will probably be pretty bad and visibility will be poor.
Several communities, including Freeport, Oxford, and Augusta, set up warming centers where those without power could find relief from the cold and snow, or simply charge their cell phones. In Bangor, City Manager Kathy Conlow opened four warming areas for the public.
In anticipation of the potential that we're going to have power outages and perhaps water main breaks, heating difficulties for people, we will evaluate tomorrow whether we open an overnight shelter. If that's the case, it'll either be over at the Brewer Community Center, but we are looking right now at the Parks and Rec building down on Lower Main.
State highway crews have struggled during the past two winter seasons to find enough local drivers to operate snow removal equipment throughout the state. Local municipalities have had better luck in maintaining an adequate workforce, but successive storms are taking their toll, says Lewiston's Director of Public Works, Dave Jones.
Well, we had five storms in December that were plowable storms. We normally only have two, maybe, something like that. So it started out pretty aggressive.
When conditions allow, state and municipal snow removal crews will begin spreading salt and sand, large quantities of which were secured by most departments during the summer and fall. Most communities are reportedly on track with their salt and sand stockpiles, but Chris Stewart, Holton's Public Works Director, said his town's 4,000 cubic yards of sand is down about 40%, and that the amount of snow doesn't make much difference.
1 and 2 inch storms use as much as the storm coming right here. It takes the same amount to treat. So if I'm going to get a storm, I'd rather get a foot than I would an inch or 2 inches because it uses the same amount of product to treat it. So,
if high winds and heavy snow wasn't enough, Portland residents had to deal with a storm surge in several low-lying areas of the city as the result of the convergence of the storm and an astronomical high tide. The storm is expected to finally leave the state Friday, but weather services say difficult travel conditions posed by cold temperatures will likely continue throughout the weekend. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
And as we just heard, today's storm did bring historic flooding to the southern Maine coast from Portland all the way into New Hampshire. Patty White has the details.
John Cannon, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Gray, says the combination of the storm and a near full moon pushed water levels to their highest in four decades.
The flood stage in Portland reached 13.79 feet. We haven't reached that high since the blizzard of 78. That's how significant this is.
State Marine Geologist Peter Slavinsky says the blizzard of 78 is actually the only storm in state history that overshadows Storm Grayson.
You know, we're seeing a water level that It's the second highest water level we've seen since 1912.
The flooding covered some roadways with a foot or more of water, and in some instances, says John Cannon, ice.
Because it's been below zero, and the marshes were all frozen up, and when the sea level and the storm surge rose, it brought that ice on a roadway. It's actually blocking and shutting down some roadways.
The peak of the flooding was from about noon to mid-afternoon. Though Friday will bring bone-chilling cold, Cannon doesn't expect more flooding. The winds will shift to push the water away from the coast and out to sea. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
The Trump administration today announced a draft proposal that would open large areas of federal waters to potential oil and gas drilling, including the coast of Maine. Jennifer Mitchell has our story.
The proposal would open most of the Outer Continental Shelf to oil and gas drilling for a five-year lease period to start in 2019. The prospect of rigs churning up the seabed in the Gulf of Maine alongside struggling shrimp stocks, valuable scallops, and the state's iconic lobster has environmental advocates furious.
So this is just a slap in the face, frankly, to anybody who wants to protect their economy on the coast.
Natural Resources Council of Maine Executive Director Lisa Pullman says aquaculture, seafood harvesting, and tourism would all be under threat from such a plan because, as she puts it, where there is drilling, there is spilling. We were unable to reach his office for comment in time for air, but in 2015, Republican Governor Paula Page became the first Northeastern governor to join the Outer Continental Shelf Governors Coalition in support of expanded offshore drilling. But his potential support appears to be in the minority for East Coast governors. Florida's Republican Governor Rick Scott tweeted his opposition Thursday to the inclusion of Atlantic states such as his in the lease sale plan. The tweet echoes concerns raised by a bipartisan group of governors along the eastern seaboard, including New Jersey, Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, and the Carolinas. Pullman says with such strong opposition from both sides of the aisle, it's hard to understand why the administration would make the proposal.
What is obvious is that they're sending a message to the oil and gas industry that we are completely behind you at the risk of pollution, at the risk of public health.
The proposal unveiled by Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke would offer up offshore blocks for lease between 2019 and 2024 and would include about 90% of the Outer Continental Shelf, including Atlantic, Pacific, and Arctic Ocean areas protected under the current five-year plan put in place by the Obama administration. A public hearing on the proposed plan is scheduled in Augusta on January 22nd. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Jennifer Mitchell.
Both Democratic Representative Shelley Pingree and Republican Representative Bruce Poliquin say they are opposed to drilling off the coast of Maine. Representative Poliquin said in a statement today that the economy and tens of thousands of jobs depend on marine and tourism industries. Congresswoman Shelley Pingree called the proposal absolutely outrageous. President Trump's decision to dissolve his voter fraud commission has made Maine Secretary of State Matt Dunlap something of a hero among progressives and voting rights advocates. It was Dunlap who successfully sued the commission, forcing it to turn over its working papers, one of several lawsuits the administration says influenced its decision to disband the fraud commission. But while some welcome the commission's demise, Dunlap says Mainers should be concerned that the Trump administration has shifted its fraud investigation to the Department of Homeland Security. Steve Missler has more.
Dunlap says the president's decision and his explanation for it confirm his suspicions about the original intent of the voter fraud commission on which he served.
It kind of tells me what their goals were all along, which was to get a voter national voter ID law and other restrictive voter laws, and to do it under the auspices of either national rulemaking or an executive order.
Dunlap is referring to Trump's tweet explaining his decision to disband the fraud commission. The president suggested the country needs a voter ID law, but voter ID is controversial. The Maine legislature has repeatedly rejected it amid concerns that it will disenfranchise voters, particularly minorities, the elderly, and college students. Governor Paul LePage and some Republicans disagree and have sought to join other conservative states in pushing voter ID. That's why the president's fraud commission was viewed by critics as an attempt to legitimize and nationalize such restrictions. And it's also why Dunlap is now being heralded by voting rights activists for playing a part in disbanding the commission. But Dunlap says the fight over voting rights is far from over.
What the implication is by taking this to Homeland Security is that they want to do this without interference. They don't want public input. They don't want protests from state legislatures or secretaries of state or individual voters. They want to get this thing implemented while they can.
And Dunlap says shifting the voter fraud investigation to DHHS could be just the place to do it. Earlier this year, DHS designated election systems as critical infrastructure, putting them in the same category as the power grid, the defense, and financial systems. The move was in response to Russian attempts to hack election systems in 2016. But it was also criticized by some state election officials as a regulatory overreach into state election systems. Dunlap says the designation could give DHS access to high-level voter information that the Fraud Commission struggled to obtain from states like Maine. And he also notes that DHS also oversees the National Real ID Law, which created identification standards for domestic air travel and accessing federal facilities. DHS can make sweeping changes to compliance standards for Real ID.
And they could layer on all kinds of conditions for compliance around elections. And then, you know, they could get access to all that voter information now held by the states under the critical infrastructure designation. So, you know, all this could happen without any legislation. And I think, you know, obviously now people are aware of this.
Dunlap says public awareness is what helped deep six the Election Fraud Commission. And if the Trump administration attempts to use the federal bureaucracy to push voting restrictions, Dunlap says his office will sound the alarm. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
The Trump administration today announced that it will rescind Obama-era rules that went easy on enforcement of federal marijuana laws. The news dismays supporters of Maine's law, but opponents say it will reopen the debate. Fred Bever reports.
Since 2013, the Justice Department has told federal law enforcement not to interfere with legal and regulated marijuana markets established by individual states, such as the one Maine voters approved last year and which lawmakers are now trying to implement. But Attorney General Jeff Sessions says he is rescinding the Obama-era policy and returning to previous policy that encouraged U.S. law enforcement to disrupt criminal organizations and tackle the growing drug crisis.
Very disappointed. This wasn't the kind of message that he gave to senators before his confirmation. It's not really what Trump said on the campaign trail either.
David Boyer is the Maine political director for the Marijuana Policy Project, which led the campaign for legalizing marijuana in Maine. He says that the policy switch will likely further stall development of a recreational pot industry in the state. He notes that legislative attempts to implement the law have bogged down in disagreements between the legislature and Governor Paul LePage.
It's a real fear because, you know, the governor said in his veto message that he was waiting to hear from the feds about their marijuana policy. And so this is perfect cover for the governor to veto the next bill that gets to his desk.
A spokeswoman for LePage says he is waiting for more information from the Trump administration before weighing in on the new policy. One prominent opponent of legalization in Maine, Scott Gagne of Smart Approaches to Marijuana, says Sessions has, quote, recalibrated the debate.
Frankly, I think it is going to open up a lot of conversation about what's the best way to move forward. It probably doesn't make a lot of sense to go forward with robust commercialization knowing that this is now in play. So I would hope that we have a good, smart conversation about how to move forward and that we're measured.
It's still unclear exactly how the new policy may play out, with individual U.S. attorneys likely to have discretion over enforcement levels. Maine's district attorney, Halsey Frank, a Trump appointee, cannot be reached for comment. First District Congresswoman Shelley Pingree says she and colleagues are working to get more information, but she believes there will be some pushback on Capitol Hill and from both sides of the aisle.
I think we've all seen in Maine, it's complicated enough for a state to figure out how to handle the legalization of marijuana, but to have the Attorney General weighing in and complicating things, which they have been doing in states around the country, just makes it that much worse.
Pingree, who says she supported legalizing recreational marijuana in Maine, says it's a matter best left to the states. Lawmakers of both major parties, she says, have supported measures to restrict funding for enforcement of federal marijuana laws and to ease laws that discourage bank participation in legalized state marijuana marketplaces.
And I just think there's a fair amount of support in Congress to attempt to prevent the Justice Department to interfere with states.
Pingree says congressional support for medical marijuana laws, which include many more states, including Maine, should be even stronger. Senator Angus King issued a statement saying that each state should have the ability to implement policy that reflects its citizens' wishes. Other members of the delegation could not immediately be reached for comments. The co-chair of a special legislative panel that's working on a bill to implement Maine's recreational marijuana law says a public hearing scheduled for Friday on its latest proposal will go ahead as planned. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
And finally tonight, 20 years ago this month, much of the state was coping with an icy disaster. Downed power lines, toppled trees, impassable roads, frozen pipes, and darkness for nights on end. Schools turned into shelters, power crews worked feverishly around the clock, and Mainers pulled together, offering hot showers and cups of coffee and swapping stories about surviving the ice storm of 98. Susan Sharon has this look back.
The ice storm crept in overnight in early January and caught almost everyone off guard.
Farmington, Augusta, Lewis and Auburn, Fryeburg, Bangor, a lot of ice, perhaps over half an inch of ice, encasing everything by morning.
And residents like Deb Conway of Poland were in the dark as the woods around her house exploded with falling tree limbs.
And for the first 2 days, all we heard was it sounded like huge gunshots really close. We would hear bang, and then as the ice would all fall off the trees when the other tops of the trees would come down.
Conway, her husband, and three kids were without power for 13 days. In parts of Maine, this was not unusual. More than 500,000 people were plunged into darkness. But families like the Conways found ways to cope in frigid temperatures without electricity, running water, and little to no heat in some cases. Then Governor Angus King declared a state of emergency. He and his young son visited emergency shelters, where King says he learned the importance of showing up and having something to offer to people in need.
So we stopped at a Dunkin' Donuts here in town and walked in, and I looked at the rack and said, "I'd like all of them, please." And the lady behind me in line said, "Could I just have one chocolate cruller before you take them all?" So we bought all the donuts that they had and distributed them to shelters. But that was a kind of reassurance. And I think that was an important, that's what I learned, was how important it was to be physically present and visible during that period.
Not since Hurricane Gloria in 1986 had Maine's largest electric utility seen so many outages. Hundreds of crews from other states were called to Maine to help out. Central Maine Power Company spokesman Mark Ishkanian was on the hot seat for 2 weeks straight. He marveled at the stories he heard in CMP's cafeteria during those dark days that he says also marked some of Maine's finest hours.
Things like, you know, a stranger coming in and picking up a check to pay for a cruise, a meal at a restaurant, or an elderly couple inviting a crew into the house to have a venison roast that had just been thawing out in their freezer. And just the sheer goodness of people under very trying conditions.
One of the highlights of the ice storm was a visit by Vice President Al Gore, who, after a tour of the damage, committed a faux pas when he picked up a downed power line and posed for cameras. That prompted some headline writers to invoke CMP's famous mantra, "No line is safe to touch, ever." But all kidding aside, even back then, Gore was hinting at how the ice storm was a sign of global warming and the havoc it could cause.
Let's all tune into this debate about what the scientists are saying is more common disasters and see what we can do to prevent them.
During the first week of the ice storm, Maine Things Considered hosts Charlotte Albright and Keith Shortall compiled an unusual list of statistics to shed light on how Mainers' daily lives were upended.
3 out of 4 telephone calls to the HQ store in Bangor have been requests for generators. At the height of the storm, the waiting list for those generators was 500. In Portland, more than 1,000 people had to be turned away for lack of supplies.
Number of light bulbs sold this week at Blake's Family Hardware in Waterville? None. Number of kerosene heaters left on the shelf at Blake's Family Hardware in Waterville? None. Increase in sales at Charlie's Pizza in Augusta? 20%.
And the waiting list of people wanting to be put up at the Fairfield Inn in Bangor Friday and Saturday? 100.
And that's how life unfolded during the first few weeks of January 1998. Deb Conway of Poland says after cooking on a grill in the dark and changing baby diapers without water for 10 straight days, she finally took up a friend's offer to go stay with her in Massachusetts. Conway and many others say they did learn one thing from the ice storm, that they take a lot for granted, and that next time they'll try to be more prepared. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Thursday, January 4th, 2018. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team. I'm Nora Flaherty.